Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special Motorsport Podcast highlight show in association with Mercedes-Benz.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC, all-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
We teamed up with Mercedes-Benz earlier last year to do a series of motorsport podcasts, and we started that month with Derek Warwick. Since then, we've sat down with Motorsport Lunch With man Simon Taylor, Jochen Mass, Cosworth's co-founder Mike Costin, Lord March, and the British Touring Car Championship boss, Alan Gow. We've taken all of them, compacted the best bits from them into one show, and here it is now. Enjoy. Now, Simon is obviously famous for the Lunch With series, and you have, over the past 10 years, you have done 125 Lunch With pieces for Motorsport magazine. So what we thought we'd do today is discuss all of the guests, how they came about, and all the stories associated with them. And obviously to be properly lunch with, we're having lunch today. And I can tell you, to be authentic to the articles, Simon has just had a beautifully presented, not very English wrap, and washed down with some sparkling water.
It was very important in all these rather glamorous lunches that I had all over the world. I mean, everywhere from Canada to New Zealand. I always stuck to water because when you're talking to these people, a lot of them are pretty sharp. Max Mosley, who was the first one I ever did, this series never set out to be something that would happen every month. I was sent by the then editor of Motorsport to do an interview with Max Mosley, because I knew Max from way back in the 60s when we were both trying to race Clubman's cars. He was almost as bad a racing driver as I was. And he was then the president of the FIA. And of course, being a brilliant barrister, he was extremely good at making a journalist think what he wanted them to think. I knew him well enough to be able to work my way through some of his clever sort of fences and ditches that he would put in the way of the conversation. And that's why I got sent. And I went to Monte Carlo. We had lunch sitting in Casino Square. It seemed to go pretty well. He was certainly very interesting to talk to. When I got back to London and submitted my copy, the sub-editor headed it, Lunch with Max Mosley. And that kind of started the trend. Readers wrote in and said they quite liked it. The editor then said, well, you better do a few more. And I then did them every single month until this month. However, the significant thing really was that when they started, they were a normal length, 3 pages of the magazine perhaps. And it was really when Damien Smith joined the magazine and said, look, we've got to try and do something a bit different. If you can write 5,500 or 6,000 words and make it interesting, I will give you 8 pages. And that was really a great breakthrough, because it then allowed me to sit down, if the the guest was indulgent enough, and usually they were prepared to do this, I could sit down with them for 3 hours. Or in the case of John Watson, at 6:45, we were standing in the dark in the pub car park, and I was desperate to leave, and I couldn't shut Watty up. So I had the ability, really, to go much further than most interviews would be able to do, most journalists would be able to do. The other thing, the whole point about having lunch, is that if a journalist is interviewing a personality, a driver, whatever, in a press conference, there are huge pressures of time, and also because it's a press conference and there's probably a PR standing behind his shoulder, and there are all sorts of worries about saying the wrong thing and upsetting the sponsor, it's always a very stilted affair. If you're actually sitting down and having a relaxed lunch, and even if I'm only drinking sparkling water, I try to make sure that the guest has whatever he likes to drink, you have a relaxed lunch, and it is extraordinary how people are then able to talk in a much more honest and direct way. And that's really been the key, I think, to making these things work.
Chris Amon, because he was one of your greatest lunch widths from your perspective as well as the readers.
He absolutely was. I mean, Chris Amon's great days in motorsport when he was driving for Ferrari, they didn't really coincide with me. I was a motoring journalist motorsports journalist by then, but I wasn't really covering Grand Prix. I was covering kind of club meetings at Lytton Hill. So I never really knew Chris Amon in period. He then disappeared to New Zealand. And so he was a man that I had admired from afar. I also knew, just from having followed what he was doing when he was in Formula One, that he was, in terms of speed, one of the very quickest of his day. I mean, he was one of the top three drivers in terms of actual speed and ability during his era. He was an unaggressive man. Maybe this is not so much in the cockpit as outside it. And when I did my lunch with him, he said that Max Mosley, when he was first driving for March, had promised him his retainer in three chunks. And he got his first chunk, his first four-monthly chunk. The second one, he had to chase and chase and chase, did eventually get it. His third one, he never got it. And he said, you know, Max Mosley still owes this to me today. But it's somehow so typical of Chris Amon. He just shrugged and left it at that. He wasn't an aggressive, hard man doing deals or in the paddock. And that equates with his unassuming modesty. He's about the only Formula One driver I've ever met who wasn't arrogant or egotistical. I mean, a lot of them are very charming and they hide their arrogance and their selfishness. But in order to be a great Formula One driver, you have to be absolutely loaded down with self-belief. And they all are. Some of them hide it better than others. But Chris was genuinely an unpretentious man, I think is the best way I can say it. He was also incredibly, he didn't really know me from Adam, but I went to New Zealand, I got in touch with him and said, I'm going to be able, I was actually in Australia at the time, it sounds very good to say, you know, I went to lunch in New Zealand, implying that I actually flew from Heathrow to New Zealand. I was actually in Australia, and I worked out that I could go to Auckland, still fair old distance, and I could be there for 24 hours. And I managed to get in touch with Chris Amon and said, look, I know you live a long way from Auckland, but is there any way that I could sort of get to you and we could have a bit of a lunch and I could interview you? And he said, look, come to Auckland. I live in Lake Taupo, and I'll come to you. And once I'd got my head round the geography of New Zealand, he actually drove for 6 hours to come and have lunch with me. And we had lunch for maybe 3 hours, and then he turned around and went home again, which is an extraordinarily unselfish thing to do. And he didn't just want to talk about himself. He wanted to talk about his mates in Formula One, particularly. What I always did with these lunches was I would say to the guest, I will have lunch with you anywhere you like. You choose your venue. I don't mind where it is. And as I've said in the piece that I just wrote for Motorsport, they varied enormously. Brian Redman wanted to go to a fish and chip shop. Keke Rosberg said he didn't eat lunch and he'd like a cup of coffee. Lots of other similar ones like that. But he said, yes, I know exactly where I want to eat. And he took me to, I met him, he sent me instructions, and I met him at a funny little cafe in a rather sort of suburban part of Auckland. And we had a perfectly good but not very smart lunch there. And he said, do you know why I chose this place to eat? Next door, have a look next door. And we went out of the restaurant, we looked next door. It was a sort of semi-detached building. And next door there was what looked like a disused small garage and filling station with a little flat upstairs. And he pointed to the upstairs window and he said, that's where Bruce McLaren was born. This was Pop McLaren's little garage, and that's why I wanted to come here. And in a way, that kind of sums up Chris Amon. Just an extraordinary man. I mean, I could talk all night about some of the people who really stuck with me. Sid Watkins, who I think everybody in Formula One, when he was the Formula One doctor, everybody adored him. He was no respecter of persons. He would be equally as rude to Bernie Eccleston or to some minor marshal. But he would also be equally friendly to anybody. And I got to know him reasonably well in the paddock. And I was only, I was just a kind of one of the hordes of journalists milling around. But he saw me walking uncomfortably once in the paddock, Spa, and he looked at me and he said, what the hell's the matter with you, lad? And I said, oh, Sid, I've got a bad back. And he said, well, come and see me. We'll see what we can do about it. Well, I was simply too shy and diffident to do that. I mean, Sid Watkins was looking after Formula One drivers. And no way did I feel that a minor journalist should go and see him about his bad back. And so I finally went to see another back specialist who said, yes, we can give you a very complicated operation and it'll cost your insurers X thousand pounds and we'll see you on Monday. On the Sunday, the day before, I was at a motor racing dinner and Sid was there and I said to Sid, you'll be very pleased with me, Sid, because I'm finally doing something about sorting out my back. And he said, oh, good show, lad. Who's doing it? So I told him the name of the man who was doing it. And he said, don't let him near you, lad. Give me a ring in the morning. I'll sort you out. So having had a rather sleepless night, I thought, well, Sid was into his third whiskey. So I'm sure this man I'm seeing in Harley Street is pretty good. And I don't really want to bother Sid Watkins with all this. So I did nothing and got my little bag packed to go off that Monday afternoon to have my operation. And at about 1:10, my mobile phone rang. I don't know where Sid got my mobile phone. He said, hell, lad, you haven't phoned me. I told you last night to phone me. What's going on? Now cancel that man you're seeing this afternoon and I'll do you tomorrow. So I did as I was told. I cancelled the man. Sid Watkins operated on my back. And it's a very long story, but I mean, that shows you the sort of man Sid Watkins. He treated, as I say, Bernie Eccleston and a minor journalist in exactly the same way. And when I went to have lunch with him, we had lunch in his kitchen. And I'd arrived there. I'd flown up to Edinburgh and I'd hired a little car and I was ready to fly back that afternoon. But lunch, sitting around his kitchen table, cooked by his lovely wife Susan, went on. And suddenly it was 6:30 and Sid said, well, we'd better go out to dinner, lad. So we went out to dinner. We came back from dinner. We sat in Sid's study. He got out a bottle of single malt whiskey. And the stories kept coming until 3 a.m. And I then crawled into his spare room bed, slept for 3 hours, and then crept out of the house next morning at 6:00, went and caught a later plane. Wonderful man, just extraordinary.
I was going to say, I was chatting to Derek Warwick about Sid at the Motorsport Hall of Fame evening. Sid was honoured this year, as you know, and Derek had quite a few sizable accidents in Formula One, and he was telling me about dealing with Sid, and he was talking about Monza in 1990, and how he'd felt fine and got in a spare car. Sid got him out of it and said, "I need to check you, and what's your name," and so on and so forth. And Derek had told him, "Oh, Nelson Piquet," and Derek and Sid had said, "No, I need, you know, you've got to be serious about this." And Derek mucked him around for a while until Sid got Bernie and said, "Tell him, unless he answers my question sensibly, he's not racing." At which point Derek came round and so on and so forth. 3 years later, he rolled during the morning warm-up at Hockenheim, finished upside down in the gravel, went to see Sid, and Sid checked him over and he was fine, but he found a bit of gravel in his ear, and he got it out and said, "I think this one might be from Monza in 1990, which I just thought was just a lovely, yeah, lovely anecdote.
Yeah. I mean, I'm always asked, who was my favourite, and it's a question I never answer because they're all so different. I mean, you imagine Richard Petty, this emperor of NASCAR.
It can't possibly be disappointing talking to Richard Petty.
Amazing. I mean, I was being shown round the museum that he's got in his place by one of his acolytes, and the door at the other end of the museum opened, and this enormously tall man, even taller because he was wearing high-heeled cowboy boots and had a cowboy Stetson hat and the dark glasses, and he was carrying this little red cup. And I'm delighted to say the article that's coming out in Motorsport, there is a shot of Richard Petty and you can see the little red cup. Reason for the little red cup is, of course, he chews tobacco. And every so often, I mean, it's very polite and, you know, well-behaved and charming, but every so often the red cup would come up and a little jet of tobacco juice would shoot out of it. Extraordinary, because when you actually probe under these people, as you know, Richard Petty's son raced not as well as Richard Petty. Richard Petty's grandson also raced, and by the time he was 18, he looked as though he was going to be every bit as good as his grandfather. And at the age of 19, he was killed. And in his memory, Petty, who owns thousands of acres round his little bit of Carolina, set up a place which is really like a smaller version of Disney World, with all the appropriate rides and stuff. And this is for children who are terminally ill or children who are desperately badly disabled. Has a full medical staff running it. And Petty just said, "Come down the road and I'll show you this place I've got." I've never read anywhere else about Richard Petty doing this. He doesn't make a fuss about it, but he just does it because it reminds him of his grandson. Extraordinary man. As we're on Americans, I know I'm interested. You're about to ask a question, but I just have to tell one of my favourite.
This is such an easy presenting job. It's great. Please carry on.
Stopping me talking is never easy. I went to do Mario Andretti, another huge hero of mine. Mario Andretti lives in an extraordinary circular house, and in the basement, sort of going round the circle, there are garages in which he's got various cars, all of which are on the button. And after we'd talked in his house for a bit, he said, "Okay, let's go and have some lunch." So we went round and he kind of walked around selecting a car, selected a Lamborghini Countach. We got into this Countach and roared off down the road into downtown Nazareth, Pennsylvania, which is where Mario Andretti's dad and Aldo and Mario, his two sons, settled when they came in as immigrants. Mario was 14. So typical of Mario, he could now live anywhere in the world, but he still lives in this rather one-horse town of Nazareth, Pennsylvania, which is where he arrived, speaking no English at all, at the age of 14. So we went to downtown Nazareth, PA, and it's not really full of Michelin restaurants. He took me to a hamburger joint, and we ate a hamburger. But of course, Mario also owns a vineyard in California, in Napa Valley, and he'd made sure that he'd obviously phoned ahead to the hamburger joint and said, when you serve us our hamburger, do make sure there's a bottle of my wine on the table. Now, the other half of this question is that I also went to see A.J. Foyt in Texas. And the way that happened was that I was having lunch with, for Motorsport, Kenny Brack, who, of course, won the Indy 500 for A.J. Foyt. And he was saying, you know, who haven't you done yet? Who would you like to do? I said, God, I'd love to do A.J. Foyt. But I kind of, I mean, A.J. Foyt is 80 and not the easiest of men. And I didn't quite know how to approach it. And Kenny said, well, I've got his mobile phone. I've got his number on my mobile. I'll dial him up. So he dialed Texas. It was probably then about breakfast time in Texas. And he said, hi, AJ, it's Kenny Brack here. Chit-chat. He said, now, I'm with an English journalist who'd like to come out and interview you. There was a very long pause at the end of the phone. And then AJ, I could sort of hear, you know, listening to Kenny Brack's phone. And after this long pause, I could hear AJ Foyt's Texan voice saying, is this Limey a good guy? So Kenny said, yeah, he's a good guy. You better tell him to come. So I flew to Texas. I went to see AJ Foyt, who was marvellous, rather large now, but absolutely as uncompromisingly Texan as he always was. And he took me to a hamburger joint because he's not in in urban, you know, he's right out in the wilds, really. And there's just kind of Texan plains, nothing around. And there's a little one-horse town which has a hamburger joint. So he said, we better go and have a hamburger. Will that do you? And of course, I was so anxious to say the right thing and sort of stay on the right side of this rather terrifying old man, that I said, oh, yes, AJ, hamburgers are great. In fact, when I went to see Mario Andretti, we had a hamburger. Big mistake. Because, of course, I'd forgotten that AJ Foyt and Mario Andretti have history. And he kind of, when I said this, the temperature in the room went down a couple of degrees. Anyway, we went to have our hamburger. And in the middle of lunch, AJ looked across at me and said, how's your hamburger? I said, oh, AJ, it's very good. It's lovely. Is it better than Andretti's?
Were you ever frightened of not being able to come up with these new ventures and new ideas?
No, not really. I mean, all that sort of story of sport at Goodwood hadn't really been particularly developed or told at that point. So that actually wasn't on that particular sort of angle, which is now absolutely critical to everything we do, wasn't really developed. My father had brilliantly sort of got hold of the race course and determinedly turned that into a successful, you know, retained its whole position in terms of the English summer and the social season, but also turned it into a commercially successful operation. But, you know, things were very difficult. They moved here in 1968, tax was 98%. And they moved in thinking they'd give it a go, and if it didn't really work, no one had any money, really. They spent, you know, I think they spent $100,000 on the whole house, which was a lot of money then, but still, you look now, it's just... And they had to, the house hadn't really been properly lived in by my grandparents since the war, so it was in very bad shape. And no one lived here, in fact. I mean, it was just opened up for the horse racing and the motor racing, and it was shut up again. So it was a massive... So my parents really took on a massive... That was a huge job, to just put some processes in and kind of get it going. And then, really, when we developed them, having had the idea to try and get the motor circuit going and really got excited and got the bit between our teeth there, then fell into the festival speed, which was a piece of luck, really. I mean, it was really... The motor circuit definitely wouldn't have turned out the way it has if we hadn't done the festival speed first. So we were given the opportunity, you know, what felt like, it felt at the time like we'd been dealt a difficult card, but actually it was the best result, really. So we had 7 years to work that out and 7 years to realize actually the great thing about the motor circuit was it was untouched. So let's just kind of put it back to how it was. And then the idea came, because we the other leases came back, the golf course lease we managed to get back, this lovely building, the kennels, came back. I then thought, well, actually, we've got, there are all these sports, bizarrely, we have all these sports here. They may all, you know, they may have been asleep, but actually they're easy, quite easy to wake up. And suddenly we have horse racing, motor racing, golf, flying, shooting and cricket all in one place, which is a unique story. And it's the authenticity around those, which is what Goodwood's really all about. As you said, I mean, over 300 years, the family have developed all these sports. That's a unique thing. But what's really unusual, really, really unusual, is the fact that they were shared in a way. So they may have raced their horses on the top of the downs. Lots of aristocrats did in the 18th century race their horses around the place against their friends, but they didn't. It wasn't a shared experience like that. The public weren't invited in. And likewise with my grandfather, he loved motor racing. But so it's interesting, why did he suddenly want to have a hold a public? Why didn't he just go motor racing there? But he decided to hold a motor racing event. And actually, from the moment the house was built, it was open to the public as well. So I would, you know, I'm very, very flattered, and I love it when people say to me at the Festival Speed, God, you know, it's been the best weekend of, you know, people do, you know, say this has been the best weekend I've ever had, when, you know, a 16-year-old says that, and then that's fantastic. Best weekend we've ever had in our lives. But why do you let all these people in? Why do you want all these people? Why do you let us all in here for, you know, for the weekend, 200,000 people? And actually, I think it's just a very good, the place, that's sort of in the air. It's not really it's just what the place is about in a way. We don't want to, I'd love to take all the credit for that, but I think it's just kind of how the place has developed itself, and the place has a very particular style and atmosphere, and that as that reflects well on a lot of people being able to enjoy it, and I hope having a very private experience, because for me the real excitement is putting on something where we have a lot of people, but everyone feels they're having a very their own particular moment.
There was a great, I think it's true to say as well, there was a great passion out there waiting to be satisfied in a way. At the beginning of the Festival of Speed, people used to ring up and say, I hear there's a V16 BRM coming to this event that you're doing. And I saw it when I was a boy, and I'm going to be there even if I have to crawl there. So there was that, wasn't there? There was a demand for this, for that kind of event, I think. And the same with the circuit, in the sense that when it shut, people were so disappointed. You know, why has the Duke shut the circuit? What's the problem? Why? Where are we going to go now? So I think there was all that. You know, I mean, 25,000 people turned up for the first Festival of Speed. We thought there might be 10 people.
Yeah, I mean, that was a surprise, wasn't it? I mean, you know, you say you sort of lucked into the Festival of Speed. I don't think it's obviously as simple as that, and it never is. But I think you were actually...
No, we really did it. Believe me.
But I think you were quite surprised with the sheer numbers.
That, well, I think what Rob said, I mean, obviously Rob was there at the beginning. Rob's the founding father. We had no idea of the pent-up demand. We thought there was an interest. And I guess, you know, now we say that we did the Festival of Speed because we wanted to sort of see how much interest was. Actually, we did the Festival of Speed because they told us we couldn't do something down there, and we bloody well wanted to do something. So we thought, well, they can't stop us doing it in front of the house because of the way the planning regulations work. Let's try it there. And then we've got a bit more, I suppose, we had to put a bit more of a serious sort of feel around the whole thing. So we said, well, look, we'll do it as a little test. Let's see if there's any interest in Goodwood and motorsport, whether anyone still makes that connection. And Rob's right in the sense then that, you know, we realised very quickly, and it was a great feeling. I mean, I think both of us would say, you know, one of the best feelings ever, for sure, was on the Sunday night. You know, we had such a, both good and bad in a funny way, but it had been such a sort of tumultuous weekend of, you know, ecstatic joy, huge amount of disappointment, terrible moments. You know, poor Chaz guy was killed on the first morning. You know, that was a pretty, I just thought it was all over at that point. We just thought, well, we've done a terrible thing, and it's finished. So it was a weird, it was a weekend that lasted for a year in a way. But as you said, we were expecting, well, we were told, I think the BARC told us we'd be lucky to get 2,500-3,000 people for something like that. You know, a hill climb,
It's probably a fair assumption, to be honest.
And we'd never seen it as a hill climb, so I would say that was a difference. We'd never said, no, this is not a hill climb. Yeah. This is something different. And then, of course, Doug Nye and Robert Brooks got very involved. They were extremely helpful and supportive in terms of sort of vision and what cars we, you know, and then they obviously had access to a lot of the owners. So we thought, well, actually, let's put something very different together. Then we got a little bit of sponsorship, amusingly, from Honda, Aston Martin, Robert, of course, Robert Brooks, as it was then, and Citroen a little bit, Aston Martin. And that was enough to cover some of the basic costs. And we thought, well, if anyone comes, then hopefully that'll be, you know. And amazingly, you know, I've told the story many times, but I wasn't sleeping much that week before. It was pouring with rain, actually. And I painted the bridge myself in the pouring rain, getting covered in white paint because it just, because the paint, the week before was pretty stressful. And I also ended up pretty much parking the cars. I remember standing on the side of the road, you know, I remember the Mason Styrons arriving, sort of waving them in, you go over there. And then poor Paul Ormond at Honda, who I'm sure many people will know who are listening to this, I can remember ringing him up on that first morning and giving him absolute hell down the phone, saying, Paul, you promised me the sign-on tent. You know, you told me you got, it was anywhere, you were looking for like 10 by 10 tent, if that, I mean, feet I'm talking about. It was tiny, size of this, smaller than this room. You know, where is it? He said, oh, don't worry, it's in the back of my car. You know, and I said, well, they're queuing to get in and we haven't got the tent. So, you know, so we didn't really deserve the success in many ways, but we certainly tried hard. I mean, so I think one thing we did realise was that it did have a lot, we didn't completely stumble on it in the sense that we felt it had great potential and we did try. So we did think, how are we going to market this? How can we get it out to a lot of people? How can we get people excited? And I think maybe for the first time we presented it in a way that no event like that had been presented, in the sense that we were presenting it to the public, not to the competitors. So it wasn't a competitor event in the sense that it was only about entry fees and stuff. It was actually about the people coming to watch it. And our model ever since then has been there's no entry fee for a Goodwood event.
When you look out the window now on a Festival of Speed morning, do you sometimes scratch your head and wonder how you've got to where it is now? Because, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's odd. I've only been here a couple of times when there isn't anything here. But during the Festival of Speed weekend four-day weekend, there's a whole town out there. And it really, especially with these manufacturer buildings, which are incredible, actually, just on their own. Do you ever think, blimey, how on earth has this happened? It's because of what a huge progression from that first event in 1993.
It is. I don't very much. It's bizarre how you just kind of goes on. And you know, I guess it suddenly got big, and you don't really. I mean, it's when people remind me, just even where it was 10 years ago, actually, or 7 years ago, how much it's grown in since then, even. But we were told the other day it was the biggest greenfield site build in the world, in terms of actual scale from nothing. You know, there's nothing. There's actually a little bit under the ground there in terms of infrastructure, but basically there's nothing there. We put enough power for the whole of Chichester, so we could run the whole of Chichester with the amount of power that goes in there. So it's huge for generator companies, trackway companies. You know, it's a massive amount of. And I don't know how many square meters we cover, but there's 200 acres out there, but it's a huge build.
I think it's quite nice to sort of rewind and go back to the Lotus days. How did you first, I'll come to you first, Mike, how did you first meet Colin and how did it all start?
Well, I hadn't had anything to do with any form of motor racing. I'd been to the odd motor race as a spectator. But a friend of mine, another apprentice, the Hoverland apprentice, Peter Ross, he suggested to Colin that I would be a likely lad to give him a hand because he's got a lot of work on Mark VI cars, and he'd split from the Allen brothers. So I did a deal with Colin, basically, that we'd work in our spare time to build kits for the Mark VI. And when we got to number 9, that would be our works car, and we would run that in racing, and that was 1953, and we would share the driving, and that was the big carrot, because I really fancied doing a bit of racing, although I'd got no idea what it was all about. the first race, Colin briefed me to if I can get behind Phil De Souter, who was the hot shoe at the time, in that form of racing, and he said, follow him and you'll learn a lot. And so I did that, and that, mind you, that was the last time I followed him. I ended up in front after that. But yeah, so that was how I started with Colin. And then Keith came along as a student from in his vacation period from Imperial College, and started working for us. And in those days, of course, I was his boss. And we struck up a friendship, and I had the greatest respect for the way he approached his engineering. And that really blossomed, because when he came and worked for us full time as the development engineer on the five-speed gearbox, the queer box that was, we were in consultation with each other as to what the mods would be that he would be putting in, and he did a fantastic job, really. But Colin didn't appreciate it, whereas I thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread. He really was, even though he was, you know, a young student, ex-student. In fact, somebody put a notice on his desk saying, "Who needs experience? I'm a college student."
Do you, I mean, of all the things that you raced, do you look back on that time as particularly fondly? Because the racing was so good. And, you know, there were good names, there were good drivers in there. All the cars are quite evenly matched. Surely it must have been some of the best racing you had.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, look, I mean, A, you worked upwards. You could see the road going this way. And, of course, it was nice. It was, you know, whatever, everything was fresh. And every race was a new venture. Oh. You know, Nürburgring in the rain again. And I was running only on three cylinders because there was some water accumulating in the plug hole. And but then everybody went round the Südkehre, which was still the long loop, the long right-hand sort of corner, and then started run again. Everybody went down to the inside, into the water. I was passing everybody around the top. And so I was first. I had the whole Nürburgring for myself. And I came back after one lap, and they all looked at me, and I couldn't see anything on the tower. I couldn't see any signs or anything. I had a one-minute lead. I had a one-minute lead after one lap.
Wow.
And then I spun, but I didn't know. So I spun at Brünnchen. I had some aquaplaning, but didn't stall. Yeah, I stalled the engines, but it didn't hit anything. Just sort of sat there on the side of the road and looking up to the corner where they should have appeared any second. And we still had batteries, and it coughed back into life. And I plucked it in the first gear quick, carefully, and continued. 1 minute, 10 seconds. And so on. So wow. That was nice. One with a second, sorry, with a minute at the end, with a broken right rear suspension, needing the whole road. But, you know, it was good. Things like that, of course, you never forget. And you know you can do it. You know that you have a little more than most of the others, so.
We've got lots of readers' questions, so I'll come on to those in a second. But we just mentioned James Hunt, who you met sort of Formula 3 time. But obviously, he sort of came back into your life again when you were at McLaren, and he joined McLaren for that famous 76 season. You were firm friends. How what was he like in F3, and then when you got to F1? Was he very much the same person between those two times, or was he sort of a bigger character when he got to Formula 1?
No, he was pretty much the same. Well, he got a bigger character then, of course. Once he joined Hiskers and he won a race, then he became... And as the popularity grew around him and all that, he felt he had to live up to it. And so sometimes it led him into some silly things, we could laugh about, but you could also look at it with a sort of a doubtful eye, whether that's the best thing for him in the long run. I said, what are you trying to run after? And so on. We sometimes talked about it, and he just laughed and so on. But, you know, I knew him from before, but I saw him one night. I entered from Germany with my Ford Capri at the time, going into London. I rented a little flat, Lansdowne Road, opposite Holland Park. Anyway, so I was on my way there, and suddenly from the side street, without any sort of looking anywhere, a Porsche came out sideways, you know. I thought, it can only be James, the way he drove. So I followed him somewhere, and then I looked. Of course, it was James. So we went to his place, and it was a lively evening. It wasn't evening anymore. It was a lively night.
But they were different days, weren't they?
Definitely.
Yeah.
The Capri. I was going to come onto this later, but your first Le Mans was in a V6 Capri, wasn't it? And you left absolutely hating it. Or did you hate it before you went to Le Mans?
No. 72 was the first time. And of course, we drove with the Ford Caprice, but it was first time confronted with this field of sports prototypes, and us with a car which was quick, all right, but not as quick. It was 50, 60, 70 kilometers slower than the prototypes. So then you were constantly glued. You didn't want to be making nuisance of yourself, you know, and you try to be out of the way on the, you know, drive on the sensible side so that you're not in the way of these Matras and Alfas and Ferraris and Porsches and, you know, you thought, damn, you know, there's another one coming. And, you know, I was just at the end of, you know, I was going right into the middle sun. And I saw these cars, these lights coming up very quick. And it was a bunch of four cars. Marco was one of them. And, you know, I stopped on the left and I sort of half turned and I stopped. And Marco was spinning and he just missed me with his nose to my car. Would have not done great damage. But anyway, so still stopped and I waved him. I said, yeah, it's all yours. So they took off and I thought, damn it. Anyway, and then through the night, and it was not really very pleasant. And it was not the racing as such, because you couldn't really race properly. To me, there wasn't a non-event in terms of racing, you know. It was not the 24 hours which irked me or anything like that, just a mixture of cars. Yes, yes. And of course, I just met Joachim Bonnier early on, you know, a few weeks earlier at Jackie Stewart's house. And he got killed in the night running over some Ferrari in the Milsan, coming down in this fast right-hander sort of. Can't even blame the Ferrari guy either, because it was just the nature of the race. And as a faster car driver, you were responsible for all your actions more than the other guy. I mean, there was a responsibility for both, naturally. But on the other hand, you're the faster one, and sometimes the guy is so occupied with his own line and behavior of his car that he's unaware of that you're coming up at such a great different speed. So it was very bad.
Was it a better experience when you got into the leading cars? You got into the really quick cars at Le Mans.
Oh, that was easy. Yeah. Talking about that, it was nice. But I'm not quite finished with this Ford Capri race, because down the straight at 6 in the morning or 5 in the morning, I thought, I wish the damn thing would blow up, because it was such an... And it did. I didn't ref it or anything. I didn't force it. Then I slowly made my way back to the pits and I said,
I'm so sorry.
It's broken. Singing it rather than saying it. And they said, then you drive the other one. Oh, I thought, no. And then Jerry came up quickly and he said, don't you want to drive? I said, would you like to? He said, yeah, of course I would. So he drove it and it was nice. And I won the class. So it was okay. But the class win in Monaco and in Le Mans is not exactly a very valuable one. You know, manufacturers can make something of it, say won the class, but nobody looks at it twice, you know, this sort of thing.
For those,
it's different now, I must put that on. It's different now, so when you have a class win now and it's hotly contested, different groups, that's different. But it wasn't then hotly contested. We were sort of trying to be polite.
Yeah, stay out of the way. For those of you watching on the video, you might have seen us all jump then. That's not because someone's been shot down here at Goodwood. That was just a door slamming. Otherwise, it would look very strange. It's all three of us going, oh, nice. They're not sort of electric seats or anything. Jochen, I'm going to take some readers' questions.
Yeah.
And I've got one here from Lucio Chiodi. I think I've pronounced that right. You shared the car with so many drivers. Who do you think was the best of your teammates? And with whom did you most enjoy racing together?
The one I drove longest with was Jackie Ickx, and I really loved him. Great kid, wonderful, wonderful co-pilot, or if you want a team partner. It was really a team partner. It was not there was no competition between us as such. Sometimes I was quicker, sometimes he was quicker. We had no problems with that. And of course, I drove with Jackie Stewart, not now. I drove with Schechter, with the Capri still. I drove with Larousse. I drove with Mazet, I think, as well. With Fitzpatrick, with... they were all nice. You know, they were all nice. We never had any misgiving. I never had a very unpleasant sort of team partner. I couldn't think of one. I had more difficult ones, like much later, if you like, in the forms of Michael Schumacher, who wouldn't leave a car alone. I mean, at night, you know, when I said, leave the car, it's good. He said, well, maybe we can do something. And I said, what? He said, well, I don't know, but yeah, maybe we can improve it. And so on. He, at 10 o'clock at night, he was still at it. And I thought, oh, just leave it alone, because that's irksome for somebody who's 20 years old. But, you know, he never changed it to the worst, so it was okay. I don't think he ever gained much by doing that, but that's the way his mind ticked, and that's the way he worked.
The I think you've just answered Andrew Oates's question. No, sorry, Bob Spry's question. He was asking were there any co-drivers who drove you mad. I guess Michael Schumacher would be that one then.
Would have been, yeah. Yes, exactly. Because,
well, this was sort of near the end of your career, and you were a mentor to that trio of cyber Mercedes drivers, Frentzen, Wendlinger, and Schumacher. Could you, I mean, you were talking a little bit about Michael there. Could you tell even then that he was different? He was had something else?
Oh, yeah, I could tell that, yes. That was, everybody could see that. He was different. He was more meticulous. He didn't seem to be outwardly that much quicker than the others, because they all reach about the same time after some lapses. But, you know, the freshest and the easiest one seemed Frentzen, driving-wise. But... Frentzen was a happy-go-lucky guy, more sort of in my line, you know, quick, but didn't reflect too much on it. But Michael always worked on it, and then at the end, he knew why he was quick and how he could improve and so on. So he always honed his driving or his style and, you know, suited to the car best and all that. And he wanted the car to be driven in a very specific way. Sometimes after race, we got back and he said, are you coming go-karting tomorrow? I said, don't you want to rest today? He said, no, let's go go-karting. So, and then he drove. I drove a few laps and he laughed himself silly over that. And I was quick in the quick corners when he didn't have to back off. But I was not so quick in the technical end, you know, with left and right and all that. But then I took times and he wanted to see what was quicker, what was better, you know, in various sections. And I said, well, here you improved, there you lost a bit. And I could see, he said, I want to drive my Formula One like that. I want to adjust the Ferrari to this sort of go-kart driving style. And that's what he did. He braked left and he was already then on the throttle and he kept it sort of on a constant slide. And I could see it, but to do is another thing. You know, I could, in the beginning, I remember one particular race with the GTA. With the 1300 in Zolder, driving against the Mini, which was from Woodhouse in Hamburg. Christian Schmeier, very quick car, good driver too. But anyway, so I drove, and I had these funny driving shoes, which are leather socks, if you like. And I braked, and I had my side of my foot on the throttle at the same time, and I could drive it like this. And it was exactly that's what they later did, driving like that with the left and the right. And, you know, but I could sense it then that this was the right way of doing it. It was perfect, you know, you got it in and you held it with half your foot and all that. And, you know, later we never had the option of driving it always because of the different cars, different pedals often. It didn't always work the same way. And later with the brake on the left and left foot braking generally made it all different.
Would you, by this, in Formula Ford, were you by now thinking, right, Formula One is where I want to be? Was that as soon as you tasted Formula Ford? Was that how quick it was, or did that...
No, I mean, I started watching Formula One because obviously 76 when I won my championships. Of course, the great James Hunt won his world championship. And also, we had the Formula 5000s were sometimes the backup race we were the backup racers of Formula 5000.
Interesting way of looking,
I got lost there a little bit, yeah. yeah. And you saw people like Teddy Paulette, Alan Jones in the Thursday's car, and you saw these great big thundering 5000s coming through Russell at SNET and places like that. And I used to just think, wow, wouldn't that be something special? So that was the nearest I was really to Formula One. I don't think I really realised I was good enough or a possibility to get to Formula One until my second year of Formula 3. You know, when we won the first five races and people really sat up and started looking at Derek Warwick, and knowing also that it was still being run off the back of a trailer in a workshop with Warwick trailers. So I think then I started to think, you know what, maybe I'm good enough, because you just didn't know, because it wasn't our upbringing, you know.
I think it's probably a good point to bring this up. Just something else I found in my archive. It's a picture I took in the Alton Park paddock in 1978.
Try not to imagine how much junk Simon has in his archive.
I was taking a picture of Doug Niven's beetle, but in the background there, again, this isn't going to work particularly well on the podcast.
You'll see a photo on the video.
A knackered old bus with Warwick Trailers, British International Formula. That is a championship-winning team operating. Can you reconcile that
with a knackered old bus?
I was
wondering whether he was going to get away with that.
It's a lovely knackered old bus.
We spent 6 months building that knackered old bus, and it was our pride and joy, because we'd put the car in the back and we'd sleep in the front. Yeah. And we went to Monaco, sleeping in the front of the bus, and preparing the car out the back. That knackered old bus was the pride and joy of Warwick Trailers, let me tell you. No, it was great to be able to go racing and keep the community together, keep all my mechanics and everybody together. And at that time, obviously, I'd met my wife, and I'd met my wife actually in when I was doing oval racing. So she was she came all the way through all that. So it was great racing. You know what I realise now with hindsight. That how we won those races in Formula 3, how we had the success we had, I have no idea. When you're racing against Nelson Piquet in the might of Rout, because Rout was really behind Piquet, you know, he was getting live engines from Pedrazzani, the Nova Motors, and I had this one engine that I just used to cherish day after day after day. It goes to show that, you know, we were competing well above where we should be, that's for sure.
I read somewhere, I think it was with the lunch with Simon Taylor you did, that the step up to F3 wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for a phone call asking for a ridiculous number of trailers that you didn't actually have space or time to build.
In the end of 76, we were flat out in the trailer business. And I was trying to convince my father to go Formula 3. We were looking at the Chevron B38. Again, my mad uncle and I got together and we put this budget together that Formula 3 was going to cost us £10,000. And we went to my dad with this budget and said, this is what it's going to cost us. We had a bit of money from BP and a few private individuals. And then our salesman came to us and said, we just had an inquiry from Saudi Arabia for 6 bow trailers. And these just flatbed, long trailers, what we call, we used to put bows of straw. And I remember my dad saying, absolutely no way, we can't fit no more in, we're working every hour God sends, you know, we just can't do no more. And I remember Pete Rawlins, our salesman, saying, well, I've got to go back and tell him something. And he said, well, quote, 3 times the price. So I remember the number, it was 6, we had to do 6 trailers, and it was £6,000 a trailer. And we were knocking them out for 500 quid or something. I mean, it was ridiculous. And so we went back and quoted these 6 trailers, 6 grand a piece, and they said yes. Well, they come back to us, and just on the back of that one order, and Dad, Stan, myself, and my two mechanics worked nights to build those six trailers. We never used the normal hours, so we could actually say that the profit from those cars actually ran the F3 cars. And it was just that order that took us through to Formula 3.
So the move to Renault, it must have been like night and day going from Tolman to Renault, wasn't it?
Well, it was also night and day going from 82 to 83. The 83 car was a proper racing car. You know, you could feel it, you understood what was going on. Of course, it kept breaking down. And we were the only driver, I think, in the last four Grand Prix to finish in the points. So we had our first points ever for Tolman in Zandvoort that year in 83. So then things really turned around for me as a driver. A lot of other people were talking about me, and obviously we started speaking to Renault to LaRousse for the 84 season, and I always remember, because we sort of negotiated, we knew where we were going to be, and I'd already spoken to Tolman and to Alex Walkridge, and we were at the racing car show at the end of 83, and my father rang me and said, are you sat down, boy? And I'm thinking, oh no, it's turned to crap, you know? And I said, come on, Dad, just tell me, what is it? And he said, I've just had a telex through confirming your drive from LaRousse. And he told me what the number was, how much it was and everything. And we got very drunk that night. you know, I mean, all of a sudden, I'm driving for a works team. You know, I'm driving for Renault. You know, one of the greatest teams in Formula One at that stage, I thought. And you know, it was at that time I knew it was going to be Patrick Tambay was the other driver. I always say the second driver. He doesn't really like that, but the second driver. And 84 was just fantastic. The car was just amazing. Again, you know, we had too many failures. You know, Grand Prix driver today, I have no idea what it was like to drive back in the 80s. You know, you broke down in more races than you finished. You know, so it was a difficult time. We almost won first time out in Brazil, and you know, we were normally quicker than Patrick. And then the crunch came at the British Grand Prix 84, and it was a great race at Brands Hatch. I ended up finishing
32
second.
Year anniversary this Friday.
I finished second, but LaRousse had put a lot of pressure on me to re-sign for the 85 season. I was already well in talks with Frank Williams to join Williams in 85. I had a little bit of a conversation with Ferrari, because remember, we didn't have managers in them days, so it was down to me. But I spoke to the Terrible Three, which was Alan Henry, Nigel Roebuck, and Morris Hamilton, who were my chief advisors. And between us, we quite rightly said the decision was to stay with Renault for 85. And of course, it was a disaster, because we lost LaRousse, we lost Michel Tetu, our chief designer, we lost Mijo, our aerodynamicist, and about three or four other engineers. Lost them all. So the 85 car came out. We took it to Brazil beginning of 85, and it was 3.5 seconds slower than the 84 car. And of course, 85 is history, as they say. You know, it was a dreadful car. It was a dangerous car. And then my career really took a bit of a dip, I suppose.
But where one door closes, I suppose, and another one opens, and that's when you got into sports cars, and you had so much success in those. Do you look back on it and think, well, actually, while it was sort of a decision in hindsight, wasn't a great one, it did open that door for into sports cars.
Look, I look back in my career, and could I have won Grand Prix? Yes. Could I have been world champion? Yes. If I didn't have that self-belief, there's no point being a driver in the first place. Do I regret not signing for Williams? No. You know, do I regret all these things? No. I had a fantastic career. I drove some fantastic cars, and I'm here. I did not break a finger in arguably some of the most dangerous times in Formula One. So what have I got to be sad about, you know? I was disappointed at the end of 85 when Senna ended up getting rid of my contract with Lotus. because I'd love to have been teammates with Ayrton. Obviously, he didn't want me to be teammates with him, so that's a backhanded compliment in some ways.
He sent you a Christmas card, though, didn't he?
He sent me a Christmas card and a New Year's card wishing me all the best for 86. Now, remember, 86, I didn't have anything. I seriously believe that he just thought I would pick up another drive, you know, and he didn't think he was finishing my career. I think he just thought that Lotus couldn't produce two number one cars, and he didn't want this Brit that he thought was maybe a threat on the other side of the garage.
How did you get to find out about the thing?
Well, I'd signed my contract, and I was called back up to Lotus Christmas 85. All bullshit thinking they're going to sign and obviously give me the signing on fee, if you like, just to be told that they've changed their mind, they're not signing me, they've torn my contract up, and obviously I asked for an explanation. They said Ayrton don't want you in the team, you know, the sponsorship is all around Ayrton, the sponsors have backed him, and we've decided to go a different way. And I said, well, hang on a minute, you know, all the drives are gone, you know, I've got nowhere to go. But, you know, Ayrton, quite rightly, they followed him because he, at that time, looked something special. And obviously, history has proved that he was more than something special.
We haven't got too long left, so I must rattle through some of these questions.
Okay.
But there's quite a nice one here about, you know, what we were just talking about, from Stephen, who says, Eau Rouge in a mid-80s turbo car in qualifying, or Mulsanne Kink in a Jaguar before the chicanes were installed?
Frightening.
Yeah, both of them, I think. I think both of them would be. I think he's wondering which you prefer. I think I prefer to watch.
I get disappointed when I hear modern-day guys talk about Eau Rouge because it's almost a straight now. It's not even a lift for these guys. For us, I mean, as you went down the hill after turn one, you had to grab hold of your what's-its in tight and you were just prayed that you come out the other side. It was pretty special. The Mulsanne Kink, you know, we were approaching that at 400 kilometres an hour in a car that was very, very floaty, very, very. You had to drive your Le Mans car with kid gloves, with fingertips. You know, it was very, 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 very difficult.
And you had Porsche 911s and slow WMs and things floating around the side of you as well.
But you see, this is where stock cars maybe come out because you know I was used to overtaking cars and being overtaken and have them on the right side and the left side and all that sort of stuff. I enjoyed it. I love Le Mans. You give me it every day. I mean, I just, you know, I do three stints in the night because, you know, nobody else wanted to, you know. If it was raining and it was dark, you know, put Warwick in for three stints, you know.
Go and have a cup of tea.
I love my time at sports cars, you know, because unlike Formula One, I always had the best car or one of the best cars. So, you know, I won races straight away, 86 with Jaguar, 91 with Jaguar, 92 world champion in Le Mans with Peugeot. And it kind of reconfirms that in the right car you can win, and I know this is going to come across awkward for some people. Winning is easy when you qualify 26th and you work your off and finish 7th. The drive of your life, and I can name one when I was with Arrows at Suzuka, and you get back to the pits and they've already gone to the airport. And, you know, you've had the drive of your life and nobody knows about it. You know, they're the days that you've got to pick yourself up on the Monday morning and convince yourself to go back and do it again.
So during this era, obviously you had Mansell come in and do some touring car races. How did that come about? Because what a coup to get in 98, Mansell coming to race. And then obviously he did the Toker shootout as well.
I can't claim total victory for it. It was a combination of myself and Robert Fennell from Donington Park, the promoter of Donington Park. Robert, we had a thing called the Toker Shootout, which is an event we had at the end of every year for a bit of a non-championship event. It was a great event. And Robert saw an opportunity with Nigel having left the World Championship and gone to IndyCar. We realised that Nigel had never been shown himself in front of the public since becoming a world champion in the UK. He's never performed in front of the public. So we made an approach to him jointly. We made an approach to him. We got Ford on side because at that stage he was racing in Indy cars with Ford as the engine supplier. So they put a car up for him. And we had just the most enormous event. You know, they had 64,000 people. It was just huge at Donington Park. And actually, if my memory serves me correct, I think that was more people than I had for the Formula One event at Donington.
I think it probably, I was at the F1 race that year, and yeah. I think it probably was.
I think it was, probably helped by the weather. I think the weather
was rubbish for the F1 race.
But it was just, and Nigel did everything you'd ever expect from him. He was fantastic with it, with the public, signing, did all the right things, said all the right things, had a huge shunt in the thing, got carted off to hospital. He just ticked every box, you know. And then we got on the front page of all the newspapers the next day because Nigel Mansell near-death experience, and it was just ticked every box you could think of. And during that race, of course, he got tipped off into the bridge by Tiff, and Tiff at that stage was a Top Gear presenter, so we had it was a huge box-ticking exercise that gave us everything we could have hoped for.
Apparently when there are problems on track, they're discussed in the bus. What on earth does that mean?
In the bus we have a fairly sophisticated system where we can review incidents. So at the end of each race, when there's an incident to be reviewed, we pull the drivers up. We have an incredibly sophisticated onboard camera and logging system, so we can play and show every movement of the car inside and from their data. So we have a very good system where they can sit there, explain their point of view to the incident, and then we'll make their decision as to what their penalty is. That's the famous come to the bus routine. Well, it's not a star chamber or anything like that. It's just
I was intrigued.
Yeah, but there are times when I don't bother playing the electronic equipment and just give bollockings. I mean that's quite a common occurrence where I don't get involved in the technical aspects. I just see what I saw with my own eyes and give them a bollocking. But that's how you run things.
I mean, obviously you want it to be a good show, because otherwise you're not going to get people through the gate, you're not going to get people watching on TV. And part of the good show is the close racing, it's the rubbing and racing, using NASCAR cliche. And the punters like a bit of rough and tumble. It's obvious. But at the same time, you don't want to condone poor driving standards. So how do you decide where the line should be drawn?
It's really difficult, and you can't just give a blanket rule, because everything's different. Every sure. incident is different. Every corner is different, and all the circumstances are different. And it's very easy for even myself and people watching on TV to look at an incident and say, well, that's black and white. That's clear. That guy punted that guy off. But you don't know until you look back at the footage. Maybe the guy in front missed a gear. Or, you know, there's things that are not obvious that you have to take into consideration. But yes, rubbing is racing, and there is a line over which, you know, once they go over that line, we will chuck the book out, you know, and we're pretty good at chucking the book at them. But normally the rule of the thumb is that if you take someone out of the race, we'll take you out of the race. So unless there are extenuating circumstances, and if you spoil someone's race, we'll spoil your race too. Right, unless there are extenuating circumstances, someone's missed a braking point or whatever. But if it's a straight punting up the punted someone up the back, speared him off, we'll take action. So there is a line, and they know where that line is drawn. But a bit of side by side rubbing and all that sort of stuff, when you've got racing as fraught as we have, and cars as closely matched as we have, that's an inevitable consequence of it.
I mean, have you been concerned? I mean, there have been some quite big accidents. Well, there were some quite big accidents in the 2016 BTCC. The Snetterton start line, for example. There were a couple at Snet, weren't there? I mean, are you concerned that driving standards towards the back of the grid do need to be improved, or do you think it's reasonably well reined in?
Driving standards can always be improved, but and without naming drivers, with any form of motorsport, the further down the grid you get, the less experienced drivers you're going to have. So that's where incidents come from. They never come from the sharp end of the grid. Major incidents come from middle of the grid backwards. And that's usually as a result of compression and everything else. But yes, we do come down pretty hard on them. And at the end of the day, they're drivers. They don't want to have their own race compromised by anything that they do, because it costs them a fortune to get it fixed. Just put them through a lot of time and expense. They don't get a good race out of it. So they're not trying to go and drive like Pratt's either. So we will give them, you know, we'll give them some encouragement. And there's a lot of drivers this year we've sat down with them, and gone through the incident slowly with them and shown them where you could have avoided that and everything else. So we don't just go in there and just thump the desk and
it's
say
it's not just bollockings.
No, not at all. We've got such a sophisticated setup that we can show them exactly what their movements were and how to avoid that and everything else.
Well, as I'm sure you'll all agree, we've had some absolutely fantastic guests in 2016. Thank you to all of them for sparing so much time and coming to talk to what can only be described as a quite unprofessional podcast team. We've got loads more coming up, though, in 2017. Some great names, really interesting guests, and I'm sure we'll have plenty more stories for you in the 12 months to come. Bye-bye for now.
Some things are made to cope with puddles and rain. Others deal with the stickiest of mud. And as for the snow, that takes a warm coat and sure footing. But when it comes to dealing with all conditions, there's only one thing that springs to mind. Mercedes-Benz 4MATIC. All-wheel drive performance in any condition. So whatever the weather or road throws at you, you're ready. To see the 4MATIC range for yourself, visit your local Mercedes-Benz retailer.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.